Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WG. We're ending the week with our good friend Dr. Art Sear, who is from the faculty at Carthage College, author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers all across the country, and who joins us on a monthly basis, as he has done so for many domestically and around the world. And Professor Sear, it's good to welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, it's always a tonic to be here, Greg. So it's always sunny. Thanks to you, whatever the weather outside, but how's that for radio?
Yeah, right.
But it's sunny today.
So right. Well, it's doubly sunny then. So, yeah, I the feeling is mutual, I assure you.
I truly enjoy it, which is not the case with every media encounter.
Right. I understand. Before we dig into some things, maybe you could tell me and our listeners what is keeping you busy and occupied this summer.
Well, I'm very proud of myself that I got the weekly. I get the weekly column. He was extremely good at keeping an eye on things while not being dumb enough to try to tell academics what to do. I learned a lot. He was our alum who went on to run Bank of America and the World Bank. Bank of America twice, the World Bank in between, Bob McNamara's successor at the UN World Bank.
So he was instrumental in having you write a column? I mean, that's something he wanted you to do, it sounds like you're saying.
Speaking of significant executives and leaders, Howard was a longtime trustee of the college, and he actually sought me out and asked me to do it. And it's worked out very well. It started with the Kenosha, went on to Scripps Howard, back when it was a news service, and I've kept it going. He thought, Clausen thought it was a great way to promote the institution.
Yeah.
And I believe males especially can deteriorate very quickly as we get older. We've both seen that.
Sure have.
Every day. And I do a number of things to try to resist those inevitable effects.
Right.
So it's a great stimulus and source of discipline. Especially when, like an undergraduate, it's getting close to midnight and I still haven't finished for the early morning deadline.
I know the feeling well. I write a column for the Journal of Singing, but it's not a weekly column. I can scarcely imagine such a thing. It's every 2 months. Burning the midnight oil and writer's block to to ease up.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, right. Well, you've written some really interesting columns as of late that I want to be sure to talk about. And I want to be sure to talk about the column that relates to tensions between North and South Korea, because, of course, one of the leading headlines at the moment is the Private Travis King. And he apparently, at some point, ran across the border into North Korea and has not been heard from since. And NPR's newscast this morning was saying that at this point in time, we know essentially nothing at all about what has transpired, where he is, what's being done to him, or and so on. I'm just curious how you've greeted this particular news.
Well, naturally, it's very sad news. He had been sanctioned and fined as a result of very vocally complaining about Koreans publicly and doing some damage to a military vehicle. He did 48 days in confinement, and he was supposed to go to the U.S. for further discipline. And he did not have one of his travel documents with him when he was checking in. I infer his military escort had left him. He was not, I don't think, under arrest or anything. And so he was sent away from the desk, and he managed to elude his escort. And it must have been pre-planned to the DMZ, and then he took off. When they reached the DMZ. So it's obviously a very unwise move, and my guess is he's probably having some difficulties mentally, emotionally, but it was certainly not a good move to go to North Korea to try to escape U.S. military discipline.
Right. One thing that kind of I find striking is just the whole notion of tourists visiting the demilitarized zone. I mean, I'm just kind of curious what there is to see.
It's very dramatic. I've been there. I've been going to Korea since 1985. I'm a great admirer of the Korean people and the Korean military. I met our Iraq Army soldiers when I was in the U.S. Army in the early 70s. A phenomenally effective military. I'm very glad they're on our side. And and they're almost all combat troops.
I remember you saying that in your column, that sometimes the presence of another nation in the midst of a conflict is almost sort of ceremonial or a sort of a gesture of support, but not necessarily actual combat troops on the ground engaged in combat. And it sounds like...
My opinion, that's undeniable fact. They would actively try to avoid dealing with the South Koreans for understandable reasons. And they had only one out of ten of our... troops are support for our military as we should in combat. And so they had almost as many combat troops as we did.
Wow. So your recent column talks about what would seem to amount to escalating tensions between North and South Korea. And what would be some of the most dramatic examples of that?
Escalating tensions are nothing new. The armistice was achieved by President Eisenhower shortly after being inaugurated by terrible aspects of war itself. The Truman administration had struggled. The Eisenhower administration made some new moves that finally broke things through. So both presidents deserve great credit for doing what they did. But it's held since 1953, 85, and I can talk about that more if you wish, but there were no tourist groups there. So the fact that there are tourists going there reflects the fact that it's actually, ironically, it's quite stable and apparently quite safe these days.
Right. So your column...
Not quite safe, but safe enough that tourists are allowed to go there.
Sure, safer than it once was. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So your column about the Koreas talks about... In particular, some of what we have been doing on behalf of South Korea, including you kind of give us a little bit of a historical background on the B-52 and its long history of usage, but also, you know, how those are now engaged in some kind of tests or something, and our USS Michigan was dispatched there. I mean, we are obviously trying to be very, very potent in our demonstration of support for South Korea.
The Michigan, I think, is an Ohio-class nuclear-armed submarine, the largest of our nuclear weapons submarines. It was dispatched there, at least one submarine carrying many cruise missiles. This highly effective, very flexible and maneuverable while in flight missile is extremely potent. And we've been conducting naval exercises and some air exercises, fighters escorting the B-52s. It's a remarkable weapon, like the 50 caliber machine gun. I think the M1 rifle, very, very durable and still around, unlike the M1 and I believe the 50 cal 50s following on the B-36 and the B-57 and the short-lived B-58. As a central part of our deterrence strategy towards the Soviet Union and China. The bomb they provided air support with conventional bombs during the Vietnam War. Our military used them very freely in South Vietnam as well as in bombing the Paris Peace Accords in early 73. They were also crucial in the Gulf War. Understandably, the media and the Pentagon emphasized high-tech precision weapons like cruise missiles, but most of the damage was done by B-52s that were based in Turkey and devastated the Iraqi army, which was deployed in trenches worthy of World War I, literally sitting ducks by Saddam Hussein, the not-so-great strategist. Turgut Özal, since things are kind of tough with our ally Turkey today, O-Z-A-L, not a household word. People should be aware of Turgut Özal, a very honest man, admirable anywhere, even in Washington, but especially in developing countries, a very honest man, a good friend of George H.W. Bush, as were many leaders around the world. Bush, that senior Bush, like Nixon, was just phenomenal, and I guess Eisenhower, but younger, more conventional politicians, phenomenal at networking around the world. Henry Kissinger has the same talent. And Turkish is an overwhelmingly majority Muslim country. They are secular constitutionally, although a religious party has been in power for two decades. Özal was taking some risk. Especially in the early 90s, in that always turbulent area by agreeing.
You talk about how, speaking of things that are nothing new, that there have been, I think you term them ominous long-range missile tests conducted by North Korea, which is what is prompting then this response from South Korea and, of course, from us as one of their allies. I wanted to ask you about something you mentioned briefly in the column, which is namely that the United States, through the UN, has been trying to discourage this activity by North Korea, but have been thwarted by China and Russia.
Yes.
So in what way have they been managing to thwart these attempts by us to rein in North Korea?
There are permanent members of the Security Council, and therefore are especially well-positioned to veto. During the Cold War, the Soviets especially were constantly vetoing positive kind of collective global efforts by the United Nations, not surprisingly. And it was generally quite dramatic. We're in a different time now. We find ourselves allied from time to time with Russia and China. The Soviet Union, while disintegrating, was part of the broad coalition that George H.W. Bush and James Baker, his Secretary of State, put together for the Gulf War. It was truly an allied effort. I really admire that President Bush, and I don't believe he deserves enough credit. He will, historically. Just a phenomenal leader, remarkable leader. The tensions in North Korea, returnest to Korea by Moscow and Beijing, kind of comes back to the fore. And they've got their own reasons for trying to exercise leverage against the U.S. Unlike during the Cold War, we're not on the defensive. Russia, and believe it or not, China, for all the media alarm nonstop, are on the defensive today. Another point to emphasize.
Paying his monthly visit to the morning show, and we always appreciate his presence and the perspective that he offers on a variety of topics.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's, like I say, it really is enjoyable for me, and it's nice to be invited back. Mm. I don't always get invited back.
Glad
don't
to have
always
you
have a second chance.
Glad to have you here. I wanted to start with the Koreas because of this local connection with Private Travis
of
King.
But no, it's very important, Greg.
Yeah,
thank you.
But I think of perhaps even more significance is the war between Russia and Ukraine, and some of what has been going on there that is, of course, quite worrisome, including, and NPR was just reporting on this again today, some of the threats that Vladimir Putin has been raising over the possibility of utilizing nuclear weapons,
yeah,
in some way in their war with Ukraine. One of the things that you tell us in a recent column that probably bears repeating is, Putin's aggressive, threatening rhetoric directly reflects the weaknesses of Russia,
yes,
and the severe drains of the war. And of course, that's in some ways counterintuitive. I mean, you know, what he's saying is scary, but it is important for us. It's not to discount it, but we need to remember that these threats are being made from a position of some weakness.
Yeah, it's a sign of desperation.
Yeah,
absolutely. He's this long direct invasion of one nation by another in Europe since World War II, invasion of any consequence at all. But he's been intervention, sliced off. They seized Crimea, and sliced off a part of eastern Ukraine in, I think, 2014, and Russian, quote, volunteers, unquote, went into parts of Georgia now, and I think that's a sign of his desperation. Clearly, the Russian army troops that went into Ukraine for the big invasion did not have any kind of long-term supplies with them. There were clearly, he thought it would be over in a few days or a week or two, and that hasn't happened. No, it's a sign that he's really up against the wall.
Right.
The Wagner Group openly rebelled. Russian generals are publicly criticized. Putin put him in as president for a term so Putin could become prime minister and change the constitution so that he could be president again and indefinitely. And those good old days are gone because Medvedev is now criticizing him publicly, I believe.
Yeah.
You know, the guy's guys in serious trouble. I tell people, especially our always anxious students and other people around 20 years old, your problems and challenges are severe at your age, but every person here, every person in this room is far more secure than Vladimir Putin.
Hmm. Interesting.
Nobody should want to trade places with this guy.
Right. And of course, on the other hand, the fact that he is feeling such desperation also means that that his threatening rhetoric needs to be heard. I mean, and we need to need to understand where it's come from. But it is not to just simply dismiss it or discount it.
No.
Yeah.
If this is reassuring, my own opinion, for what it's worth, is if he ordered the use of nuclear weapons against Ukraine or anyone else, I don't believe those orders would be followed in today's Russia. Even if they were, God forbid, Russia would be devastated. My guess is NATO would respond with an enormous conventional attack that would, in effect, put Russia out of business as an economy and a society. That's what I think would happen. But as with the DMs, but it hasn't, they haven't been used again, and it's important to keep that in mind.
Hmm. I did want to ask you quickly about something that has emerged over the last few days, and namely what has been termed by some as Vladimir Putin using food as a weapon. The fact that the Ukraine grain deal, which I think was signed approximately a year ago, Russia is, in a sense, pulling out of that, believing. I was sort of staggered to read to what extent Ukraine is a really significant grain supply is equally frightening in terms of what the long-term ramifications or far-reaching ramifications could be.
I guess I probably don't agree with that. I'll have to think about it more. But for our listeners, Russia relented and let grain, I guess through the Black Sea, come through the Bosporus Strait and out into the world marketplace. And you're right, Ukraine is a major global supplier. And again, I think a sign of desperation. He agreed to let grain products out early in the war, and now he's, I think it's, again, it's a sign of Russia's problems. We do live in a very global economy, and when the war started, there were predictions that this would have a big effect on agricultural prices. But obviously that hasn't happened. Thanks to the efforts of the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation, Norman Borlaug, a brilliant agricultural scientist, I think at Purdue, developed something, and associates developed Miracle Rice way back in the 60s, maybe 50s, and that has transformed agricultural production in the world. We have a global economy that really does adjust in remarkable ways. I've wondered why the current inflation hasn't turned into the stagflation of the 70s, struggled through as a young person, and early 80s. And I do believe the enormous flexibility and efficiency of the global marketplace is a big factor in that. So my guess is that this latest effort by Putin will not have a huge effect on the global economy. But Ukraine, we mustn't be complacent or overly optimistic. Russia has a 3-to-1 advantage in numbers, no matter how mediocre the performance of the Russian army so far, and it's terrible. They do have the numbers, and the Russians historically know how to take gigantic casualties and still keep going. Against the Wehrmacht, between 41 and 45, against Napoleon, they are capable of taking huge casualties and still keep fighting. They outnumber Ukraine, and they have, again, in physical terms, lots of advantages. And you don't want to underestimate Putin. He's survived for more than two decades. He's obviously a genius in many important ways.
We will shift our attention now to, more specifically, to NATO, and you've mentioned NATO already once or twice in talking about the situation between Ukraine and Russia. There was a NATO summit that occurred a little earlier this month that President Joe Biden attended. Tell our listeners the most significant things that emerged from that summit.
Well, President Zelensky of Ukraine, an authentic warrior, and a very brave man. He doesn't have to do this. He and his wife, he's been financially very successful. He and his wife and family have a villa in Italy, I believe. I believe he deserves a lot of respect for his courage. Like a lot of warriors, he's not the greatest diplomat or flexible politician in the world. But it's great he was at NATO, and the war has re-energized NATO. And I think we should, as Americans, be very proud of our allies and ourselves for doing the right thing and not doing reckless things to defend Ukraine. So the summit meeting underlined that.
And has re-energized the alliance. That is, there are ways in which NATO is stronger right now than maybe it's ever been, exactly because of this threat from Russia.
Exactly. It's a remarkable success story. Now, bureaucracies have a strong desire and tendency to be self-perpetuating and protect themselves. Former President But that's just the nature of organizations and people, something I'm very much aware of as I get older in terms of what I ought to be doing. The things including culture and arts as well as business and the economy is extremely good at describing Atlantic area relations. And look into The Economist, readily available online or at your library. They've had some very insightful essays about NATO, especially lately. It's the most durable military alliance in history in Europe. The Napoleonic Wars, it was 1947, NATO's 1949. But nobody really pays attention to the Rio Pact. So technically, there are other durable alliances. But NATO, much more an alliance of more equal nations than the U.S. and Latin America, is really quite a phenomenal success story. And they do a lot of good. Humanitarian relief during COVID, NATO assets have been made available for transporting medical supplies, food supplies to beleaguered areas.
Yeah, that was a point you made, too, talking about NATO's range of positive and productive activities beyond traditional military defense. So
exactly.
That's kind of a story of NATO that maybe doesn't always get told sufficiently.
Well, it's the story of the media, the contemporary media, in my biased opinion, and there I am biased, but they don't pay enough attention to the positive aspects of our military. On more than one occasion, when there's been a devastating earthquake in a city on a seaport, a major third world city, a U.S. aircraft carrier has appeared into a U.S. aircraft carrier, and for a while at least, the city has power again. And we're always engaging in humanitarian relief. It gets mentioned in passing.
Right.
But I think it's especially important on NPR, if I might say, to emphasize back on all. That's an important point. When President Kennedy made a carefully prepared speech on October 22, 1962, announcing the public beginning of the Cuban Missile Crisis and our blockade of Cuba, he referred to the Rio Pact. Any nuclear missile launched against any country in Latin America will be considered an attack on the United States, and we will retaliate in kind. Under our definition, Article 5 is initiated and NATO is at war against Russia. It's crazy as hell for I realize that President Zelensky has been publicly, he's kind of biting the hand that feeds him, but it's important to be patient.
Right.
Eisenhower liked to say patience. Patience is a form of courage. And Ike was always right. No, I wish Zelensky would shut up once in a while, but he's great. But no, it doesn't make any sense to me at all for Ukraine to be joining NATO. But
right.
Understandably, that's what the Ukrainian fighters want. And certain armchair warriors, some of them in Congress in this country, wanted it. But
yeah, that would trigger far more widespread warfare that could really.
Exactly. Yeah. Beware of people who sit on their behinds and lecture the world about what it should be doing, especially those who have real political power.
Interesting. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, and we're going to finish up now his monthly visit to the morning show with a conversation more domestically focused, specifically on the recent debt ceiling agreement that was brokered really primarily between Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy and President Biden. I wanted to mention, Professor Sear, that, I saw your column. And it's a book, a really interesting book that explores kind of the whole notion of what debt is and the difference between government debt and private debt and so on. And also makes the point that a certain amount of debt is but essential for a nation's economic well-being and economic growth. And then at some point there becomes too much debt and debt is no longer a constructive force, but more of a destructive force. So,
what's the name of the book?
It's called "The Paradox of Debt," and just published. But it just in that shorthand, rather rough summary, does that make sense?
Yes.
What he is saying about debt?
We've always had public debt, almost. President Andrew from the beginning of the nation, businesses go into debt all the time. It's called investment. Unlike businesses, the U.S. government does have a reliable income base, which can create all kinds of problems and complacency. But a government is not like a business in that sense. But debt itself is not bad. We've always had public debt, except during President Andrew Jackson's administration. He was kind of a wild, crazy guy. He hated bankers. He hated finance generally. Another great warrior.
Yeah.
And I believe he was, in many ways, a great president. He destroyed the Bank of the United States and got rid of the public debt. He is unique in that regard. As long as I've been alive, there have been complaints about overspending in Washington and the problems of big spending, not our total assets, public assets, but compared to our gross domestic product, which is a reasonable. And I think it's good that there's growing pressure, but, and there is a constituency for that. Bill Clinton actually reduced federal spending during very good times and got credit for it. In this century, both parties have been big spenders. George W. Bush, in particular, set a very bad example and changed the Republican Party. I hope not permanently in that regard. But there is a constituency for emphasizing balanced budgets. I think it's very good that there's growing emphasis, I hope, on reining in debt. But it's important to keep in mind that since 1940, the nominal GDP of the U.S. has doubled every two decades. It's just an incredible performance, and the standard of living will decline. That hasn't happened in this country because of the incredible attraction of the U.S. for foreign investment. Especially starting early in World War II.
Right.
But it's just continued, rain or shine. I hope that's clear.
Yeah.
But debt per se is not necessarily bad.
Right. It sounds like, although there's, as you said, kind of a recent history of escalating spending.
Yes.
I believe your column makes specific reference to COVID and the fact that that seems to have been an event that, in a sense, triggered even more of an uptick in our spending, and we haven't, in a sense, come down from there.
I think basically it was desirable public policy, very assertive government. I myself believe the lockdowns were overdone, and local as well as national authorities intruding into everybody's life was overdone. I think I'm right, and that's one reason why Dr. Fauci has completely disappeared from view. But I think it was basically good public policy to respond very aggressively.
Right.
Especially with the tremendous power of science and technology. I grudgingly vaccine as soon as possible. But it's also a sign of a humane society and a sign that our standards are very high in terms of public health. There's not the the Spanish flu epidemic during World War I, that's the last time we had this. In 1968-69, about 300,000, mostly young men returning from Vietnam service, spread the President Lyndon Johnson was in the hospital, including intensive care, for about 2 weeks. The White House said it was a cold and physical, just a basic overall physical checkup and review for the president, but that wasn't true. I'm old enough to remember law enforcement, first responders, military police, hospital people wearing masks. But otherwise, you went to work, remote work. The vast majority needed a paycheck, like today, but even more, and you just went to work. That's life. Tough. We had serious flu epidemics in at least twice in the late 1950s. So it's not, COVID was nothing new, and I think our response was actually a very good sign overall. I hope that's clear. I realize it's a different point of view than what's right. often expressed.
The point I was making is that, I think in your column you said that our response to the COVID pandemic included, you know, an enormous amount of spending.
Yeah.
Perhaps fully justified, but nevertheless, it kind of took us, our spending, up to yet another level. And I think what you're suggesting is that this sense of we need to start reining this in is a natural response to that surge in spending that occurred during COVID.
For quite a while now, we've gone in eruptions when the Republicans took over with Ike. And just before, he was a phenomenal speaker. It used to be a more nonpartisan office, in part because I believe with the war we started to imitate our British friends in lots of ways. Good ways, mostly, and it was a nonpartisan office, like the Speaker of the House of Commons. And read about Sam Rayburn, Mr. Sam, Speaker Sam, good, close ally of Lyndon Johnson.
And speaker good, for a good. Long time.
That's my point, yeah. And a truly brilliant man, like LBJ in legislative terms. I hope Johnson starts to get the credit he deserves.
Well, on that note, it's time to finish out what's been a lively and wide-ranging conversation, as always. And it's always a pleasure to have you here on the morning show to hear your perspective on various issues. And it's often a perspective that is maybe slightly against the grain, or certainly in contrast to the way certain issues often get simplistically framed. I'm really glad that we can have you here to share your thoughts and insights, and look forward to your future visits very much.
It does me a lot of good. The feeling's mutual.
Dr. Art Sear joining us today on WGTD's Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find The Morning Show archived on our website, WGTD.org. If you want to rehear any conversation or listen to a Morning Show conversation that you missed altogether. And don't forget that you can also hear The Morning Show as a podcast to hear a different Morning Show 7 days a week. Here's our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. Sunny and warm with a high of 81 degrees, so actually quite a beautiful day. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 63. Tomorrow, Saturday, sunny and warm with a 30% chance of rain. Tomorrow's high, 82. We do warm up to 85 on Sunday, to 87 on Monday, to 89 on Tuesday, into the low 90s for a high in the middle of next week. This is WGTD HD Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva. And